Okay, the next topic, we're going to go back to revenue recognition. No. You have to do it with flair. Okay, we're going to go back to revenue recognition. We're going to start with paper 4D this afternoon. D as in dog. Yep. And I think one of our postgraduate technical associates is going to kick off this topic. Stephanie, I think this is your first meeting with the joint board, so I'll ask everybody to be especially pleasant in their questioning of this memo. Stephanie, over to you.
Thank you, Leslie. Memo 137D considers improvements to the proposed requirements for combining contracts. That is, this paper provides guidance on when two or more contracts shall be combined when entering into a contract. Memo 137C on contract modifications discusses subsequent amendments to existing contracts. In the exposure draft, the boards proposed that an entity should apply the principle of price interdependence to determine whether an entity should combine two or more contracts and account for them as a single contract. Additionally, the boards proposed three indicators to determine whether two or more contracts have interdependent prices. Most respondents agreed that an entity should consider price interdependence for determining whether to combine contracts. However, some thought the principle of price interdependence was confusing. Some respondents suggested alternative principles, such as those in existing standards. For example, two or more contracts would be combined in accordance with IAS 18 revenue if the contracts are linked in such a way that the commercial effect cannot be understood without reference to the series of transactions as a whole. Other respondents suggested that an entity should also consider additional indicators to determine whether two or more contracts should be combined, such as technical and functional interdependency of the goods or services in the contract and payment interdependency between contracts. Additionally, some respondents suggested that the boards clarify that in order for two or more contracts to be combined, the contract must be with the same party, which would be consistent with existing requirements for multiple element arrangements in ASC 605-25. In light of the responses to the exposure draft and the FASB education session held on February 10th, the staff recommends that the first indicator in paragraph 2B1 of the paper be moved to the principal in paragraph 2A. Therefore, the staff recommends that an entity should account for two or more contracts that are entered into at or near the same time as a single contract if the timing or amount of revenue recognition would differ depending on whether the entity accounts for the contract together or separately. So the first question for the boards is, do the boards agree with the staff's proposed principle for combining contracts? And I'll turn it back over to the boards for further discussion.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. Comments?
Agree.
If we're just focused on question one, and Stephanie and I agree with that.
You want to repeat that just so Stephanie hears
okay,
it?
Okay, sorry. I focus in on question one, and as your proposed amended recommendation, I agree with that recommendation.
Stephanie, are you asking us essentially about all of paragraph two at this point, or just the beginning?
Just the principal portion of it.
I didn't hear you.
Not the indicators.
Okay.
Yeah, Leslie, it's just the principle in paragraph two, but we need to take into consideration the indicators B1. We have moved it to the principle itself. Okay. So the first question we're just talking about just the principle itself, that is 2A in the paper.
Okay. Yes.
So Larry, what she did is she took B1, the contract. So I think it would read
when contracts are entered to at or near the same time, and then it'd be the rest of 2A.
Right.
Okay. And I agree with that.
Does anyone disagree? Or Tom?
I disagree because I think that there's a circularity here. We don't know the timing of revenue recognition in this model until you go through the whole model. And so I don't think you can have an objective that says you combine contracts if the timing or amount of revenue recognition changes, because you're first trying to decide what the contracts are that you will decide timing and amount of revenue recognition for. So it's not clear to me that you need the separate objective, that you could run into, go to question two, and just say when two contracts are into or near the same time, they should be combined and accounted for as a single contract if, and then go through the four criteria after that, So there's a circularity in the objective that I think will trip us up.
Okay. Philippe?
I guess my comment is about more the operational aspect of this principle to which I agree. How do you know that you would have a different accounting results until you have really done all the exercise and made all the mechanics of the two accounting? I think it's more or less the same point as Tom. I also have some questions on the indicators, but maybe we can take it after. It's about the linkage. There is a lot of tension placed on the related entities. Contracts are with the same customer or related entities. And if I contract with a government-owned entity, and I have another contract in China, we go with another entity owned by government, should I say, they are related entities, so I have to combine all those contracts together? Related parties, what is the definition here of related entities?
Okay, let's hold off on the indicators for now. PK?
Yeah. It's Jonathan.
Oh, I'm sorry. John?
I didn't want to hold off on them because I agreed with Tom. I thought when I read the indicators, contracts entered in at the same time, that doesn't tell me anything about whether they ought to be combined. It's telling me there's a red flag. Go look and see if the revenue would differ depending on whether you had one or two.
That's why we moved that up.
Say again?
That's why she amended it. So it's not in D, it's in A.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't catch that on the fly.
You saw it at the end of the day.
Here's Paul?
I support Tom's recommendation that we really don't need the basic principle, but the criteria will do it. excuse me. Yeah, getting choked up over this. Very emotional.
I didn't catch that on the fly.
What's that?
I didn't hear that as a recommendation.
My recommendation was no principle and just go to the question two, but elevate one and one from two.
Be part of that.
Yeah, part of the lead-in.
Okay. Larry?
I totally agree with Tom. Even with moving just B1 up, I still think it's circular, the principle. So I would just put it all together. I don't know how to answer it when you just, you know, try to evaluate whether two or more contracts or a single contract, you know, if the timing, it's very circular. You can't do it. It's a lot easier if you just state what the indicators were. And I think Tom stated it almost perfectly before.
But it seems as though you could be wasting your time if you go through these indicators and combine contracts that involve the same sorts of deliverables, so it doesn't matter if you combined them. I bet the staff can respond to it. It seems to me you may have inefficiency in this regardless of the order in which you approach this.
But again, I think to clarify, we're not saying that an entity has to go through the accounting and document, you know, both ways of doing it. But one thing that became evident when analyzing comment letters was that a lot of people seem to not get why we have this principle for combining contracts. And that reason is, in paragraph 4, it's the fact that entities can structure contracts in many ways. And we think the accounting should reflect the current rights and obligations and not simply how the contracts are structured. So I think that in practice the pressure will be mostly on the indicators, but we thought it would be helpful to tell people why it matters.
Without stating it as a principle.
Well, we could put that, draft the standard and just say to prevent, you know, different accounting just based on the structuring of the deal, you know, you need to consider whether to combine them. Consider these indicators.
I mean, just thought of the basis for why yes. We gave guidance on when to combine contracts.
Right, and then it won't be circular. It will be in the context of the whole standard.
Yeah, that's fine.
We ready to move on to the indicators then?
Yes.
Okay.
So therefore, to help an entity apply that principle, the staff proposes the following indicators. The stat, the contracts are negotiated as a package with a single commercial objective. The amount of consideration received in one contract depends on the terms or performance of the other contract. The goods or services in the contract are closely interrelated or interdependent in terms of design, technology, or function, or the contracts are with the same customer or related entities. Therefore, do the boards agree with the staff's proposed indicators of when two or more contracts should be combined?
Mark?
Question. I think Stephanie just put an or where there was an and.
Exactly.
I just want to catch that. Was that intentional, Stephanie, or?
Yes, it was.
It can't be an and.
Let's be clear. What paragraph are you talking about?
Well, I was talking about the question.
Yep. And between 4 and 5?
Yep. Just wanted to make sure that everybody was on the same page as this is an or, not an and.
It's an or?
Well, she said an or. That's why I wanted to catch it. Now I've got to think about it.
It's just a list of indicators.
It shouldn't really make any difference.
It's they're just not criteria.
The reason why she changed the or and and without shouldn't change substance, it's a list of indicators. So you consider A, B, C, D, or E.
I'd say.
If you put and, well, whatever. If you put and, you've got to almost, it would read as if you've got to meet all four. But if it's an indicator, you don't have to meet all of them. I think is why the or has been put there rather than the and.
And that
correct.
Is the reason why.
Yeah.
That's what we got from the education session on February 10th, that there was some confusion because we originally had and in the list of indicators.
So how does it work? Just tell me in plain English.
Or
each of them is separate indicators.
This,
or this.
No, it's just, it's a list of indicators. You consider all of them to think about. I mean, and they were set against that principle. So in other words, even if the consideration in one contract depended on the performance of the other, you only needed to combine the contracts if you'd get a different accounting effect if you combine them versus accounting for them separately. And that's why we sort of set it up with that principle and then have those indicators.
Just say one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've had this problem previously, and I can never remember which way is the right way of doing it, to be honest.
Delete the word.
All right, Alan, maybe you can tell us what the rule is.
Well, there's no rule. There's never any rule. I was just going to say...
I meant the rule about and or
all. It's a principle.
When we did BizCom together, in IS 27, when we had loss of control, we dealt with this sort of issue. I think I don't know the codification chapters it's in, but it's... was it 141? I'm trying to remember which one it was, the old standard. And we had, they're very similar. So I don't want to get into drafting this, but we actually said, should one or more of the following may indicate that the parent. So that becomes inclusive. And I just think it would be helpful, and we can do this offline, but the four criteria we identified there or the indicators are actually qualitatively similar to the ones we've got here. And I think if we can get some consistency, given that it's in both US GAAP and IFRS's, it might be helpful to do that. So,
can I ask you some stupid question? I'm allowed one other than
a
Pat.
A stupid one?
Yeah, other than Pat, yeah.
No question they normally ask.
I didn't say you. Now, question is that if it is not with the same party, why do we need to worry about it? Yeah. I thought combining contracts is an issue when you're dealing with the same counterparty. So and was very important for me. And I don't understand why, if it's not with a related party and Alan and I happen to enter with Pat Finnegan at the same time, do I need to combine this contract?
Perhaps.
That's not the intention. The intention is that if Alan and I are related, which we are not, but if we are related and Pat Finnegan enters into it, that's when you need to think about doing this. I think these are not our conditions. This is an and condition.
Well, alternatively, you could say you want 5 to be elevated to the top.
Yeah.
So when contracts are entered into it near the same time with the same customer-related entities,
then you need to do
consider it. Combining if one of the three conditions are met.
People agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Now, we brought this up at the Ed session, and I'm sure that Prasad wants to give the same response as the Ed session.
I was not there, so I'm sorry.
Prasad.
Yeah. The reason why we didn't put it as part of the principle and we made it as an indicator, because for construction contracts, there are certain fact patterns where a contractor may look at it as a single commercial objective. That is, I'm building a home, and the first floor is, say, PK is occupying the first floor, and the second floor is occupied by, say, Russ. As a contractor, I might combine those two as one contract and view it as one single commercial objective. I'm building a home. So that was the reason why we made it as an indicator, but I hear the arguments why it should be in the principle, but outside of construction, generally people view it as the principle is it. They evaluate whether the contract is with the same customer. So that's the reason why we made it as an indicator.
I don't care whether it's an indicator or something, but it should be there. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Paul, did you still want to get in?
Okay. I think the change that we agreed, Tom's change that we agreed to, elevated these from indicators to more than indicators.
Agreed.
This is now our principle. I agree with PK that if it's not with the same counterparty, we're going to end up combining things that are completely unrelated. So at least I would do what someone suggested, elevate V5 here up to the guts of the principle. Tom suggested it. But I would leave and just say these are... I would leave it as and. I think this is now our principle, they're no longer indicated.
Back to Alan's point, though, Alan. Is that how it's done in that guidance?
Does it
limit it to same parties, including related parties?
No, it doesn't, actually. It just talks about when one or more arrangements ought to be treated as a single transaction, and then gives the list of indicators. But I suspect, it might have been a presumption in here when we developed it, as opposed to having to say it explicitly.
I'm not sure I understand Paul's... Paul said it's not indicators, now it's criteria. I'm not sure, because contracts are entered into all at the same time. Is that sufficient to say, without all the other indicators, then you must combine them?
No.
If it is with related parties? No, I don't think so. It's not sufficient. It's a red flag. Someone said it's a red flag. It triggers an assessment of the other criteria or indicator, whatever.
I think that's why I wanted to end.
Okay.
Steve?
Henry, when we had the meeting with the telecoms industry, that there was a scenario that they presented to us with a triangular situation, one party with a contract with one party contract there, and then back down to the first one. And the only way you could get sensible accounting for that was to combine the contracts, the two contracts that one party has with two other people. And it seems to me, therefore, that we shouldn't have a requirement that the contracts have to be with the same customer, because in that situation, because of the existence of the third contract between the two parties you're transacting with, you need to be able to look at the whole arrangement to get to the sensible accounting.
Are they related, those parties? Are they related on the...
No, I think it was, I'm a retailer, I'm contracting with my retail customer, but I'm also contracting with another supplier, and then the retail customer contracts with the supplier. It's the telecoms mobile phone situation, but it's a particular scenario in the mobile phone. It's not contract between mobile phone company and a customer. It's where you've got the store in the street that contracts with the customer, contracts with the mobile phone company, and then the mobile phone company has a contract with the customer.
Doesn't that extra contract make you a related entity, though?
Yeah.
If that makes us related, then that's fine.
It could be agent also.
It's an agent.
But I think
it's not an agent. Well, apparently it's not an agent.
I can't remember exactly what the scenario was now off the top of my head, and I'll probably get it wrong if I try and do it. But it seemed to me that we needed to make sure that that could be dealt with as two combined contracts in order to get sensible accounting.
Okay. Pat,
again.
Conversely.
Henry or Kenny or anybody, this conclusion
doesn't necessarily drive or influence the conclusion as to the evaluation of performance obligations, right? So you could still have two contracts coming together, and you could either have a single performance obligation or you could have multiple performance obligations.
Correct.
So this criterion, for example, for the goods and services in the contracts are closely interrelated, interdependent in terms of design, technology, or function. If you conclude that you have two contracts, two distinct performance obligations, when you put them together, you would still have two distinct performance obligations.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right.
I think I'm just thinking about what Steve has said. I have to say, it is because of factors like that and other factors that we've not thought of. It just does make me very concerned about making this a hardwired requirement to combine contracts. And I think that is exactly the reason why we set it up the way that we did, is to try and give you a reason why you've got to combine. And then these are some of the, as you said, red flags that would highlight in these situations, think quite carefully whether they need to be combined. But we didn't want you to force combination in these situations, nor did we want to preclude combination in other situations whereby clearly economically you need to combine those contracts.
And I know what it is now. It's Carphone Warehouse contracts with Vodafone, also contracts with Nokia, but then there's some sort of subsidy going on as well. It's something to do with that.
You know, I'm just very comfortable about, uncomfortable, I think, about rewriting this and saying you combine if you tick A, B, or C.
Do you accept Tom's suggestion of dropping the principle?
I think, personally, I think the principle, I appreciate that we didn't have it very well drafted originally. I do think the principle is helpful. I appreciate that theoretically there's a circularity behind it, but then I think that it does provide a guidance for people to be able to sort of say those contracts should be combined.
Yeah. Put the circularity aside. On its face, doesn't the principle as written in question one say that if you've got two or more contracts that would produce different amount of revenue, you have to combine them? Because it's divorced from these indicators. So you've got a principle that says if you've got two contracts and they produce revenue at a different time, you have to combine them. It doesn't make any sense. Without the indicators, it doesn't make any sense. The principle on its own, without the indicators, doesn't make any sense. No. It says if you have two contracts...
If you would get a different answer, counting for those contracts together than you would do separately, then they should be combined.
Period. End of conversation. So without the indicators that say they were entered into at the same, they might have been entered into at the same time, or with related parties, or they're interrelated, with the indicators it makes sense. But without the indicators, the principle on its face just says if you've got two contracts that would produce revenue at different times, then if you combine them, you have to combine them. That doesn't make any sense.
It's the interrelated nature of the contracts. It's not the timing that's the point. And if you're going to put a principle, it's got to be the interrelation. The contracts are intertwined. I mean, that's what we're really trying to get to.
So
here's the indicators that they are intertwined.
It is okay. But the principle on its own is stated in question one by itself. Just would force you to combine all contracts that would produce a different revenue pattern if you combine them.
I'm sorry, having a blank because I don't see.
David's right, it's interrelated. It can't be amount. The only reason the amount wouldn't vary is one contract gets all the revenue and there's zero in the second contract.
No, there could be an allocation issue.
So then if it's not amount, it has to be timing, and the only way you decide timing is to go through the whole model.
Okay, Elka? Is as valid if you turn it around. Indicators without a principle, what you want to achieve by the indicators don't make any sense. So I would probably argue that we have to get the words right on the principle and then have the indicators to help us out.
Me too. I mean, when you think about where else we do this in GAAP, the step acquisition situation, liabilities and equity, We've done this in other places, and you're trying to explain what you're trying to achieve, and I guess we just haven't landed on it yet, but I understand what you're trying to do. I don't have a suggestion at the moment for how to improve it.
But I think that's more wording.
Yeah. Amara?
I generally like principles, but I prefer having only the what we call criteria or indicators, because I may have such a difficulty trying to translate this to Portuguese, to be honest.
So
and I guess it would be the same in Spanish and French. No, no. Because for me it's a strange English way to construct an English principle, at least not being an English spoken people. So I understand the meaning, what you want to say, but it's very difficult for me to translate it in any other language than English. And even in English it took a little bit time for me to understand. So I don't have, of course, a better way to describe this. I would describe directly what we would like to say as a principle, and then having the additional indicators if necessary. But surely it will be very, very difficult to translate it in other languages.
Tom?
I think David hit on it. Contracts are interrelated and should be combined in certain conditions. And I think if we just say that, contracts are interrelated and should be combined if they're entered into at or near the same time and meet one or more of the following conditions. Because conditions 2, 3, and 4 are all about interrelationship of price, of design, technology, or function, or a single commercial objective. That's all in a relationship. That begs the question whether 5 stands alone, and I'm not sure it does, that a contracts are with the same customers or related entities. The same customer, I guess, is in a form of interrelationship, and so is related entities. It still feels to me we should take that 5th one and put it up in the top. Contracts are interrelated if entered into at or near the same time with the same customer-related entities and meets one or more of the following 3 conditions. And then you got 3 interrelationships that are existing in 2, 3, and 4.
I thought I heard some concerns about the same party.
No,
maybe we could say generally with the same party.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think generally is good. There are these things called round-trip transactions where I sell something to Amaro, Amaro sells something to Tatsumi, Tatsumi sells it back to me, and all we did is just grossed up all of our revenue. We entered at the same time. It's all I don't pay, Amaro doesn't pay me till cash circles around. That should all be netted. So we want to make sure, but yet all 3 of us are unrelated, but we all got together and did this transaction. We want to make sure that's...
No.
But it doesn't matter. This is about amount of revenue. Gross versus net would be part of the amount of revenue.
I'm fine with generally.
I don't know. We actually try not to use that word, but.
Yeah. We also make clear this is a decision at inception that carries through. Because how it intertwines with mods, which are something that I think modifications, which should be something that happens after inception.
I have a similar point that Tom raised. It's that should I be thinking about combining contracts only at the time of inception of the contract? If so, for me, combining contracts and contract modification should flow the same logic. The reason I bring that up is because one of the conditions that we have removed in the contract combinations is the concurrence of the occurrence of the transaction. Whereas in a contract modification, concurrence of the transaction is one of the biggest factors for contract modification. So I wanted to understand the logic why contract modification and contract combination not stay in the same page, because I see them as same continuum.
I raised that point in our discussion.
You read that note.
Stan?
In terms of what we thought about is like combining contracts, if we apply the same principle, like for the same reasons, when there's constant renewal contracts, when there's a renewal of a service contract, if you apply these principles, it'll automatically be combined and it'll always continuously be treated as kind of like a cumulative effect adjustment. So in order to avoid that effect, we basically thought combining contracts, it'll be at that outset. But for modification, you'll go through a separate kind of evaluation, and we'll get through that paper in the next session.
So are people generally supportive of Tom's suggestion to have a lead-in that says something like, when contracts are
Contracts are interrelated and should be combined.
When
they are entered into with at or near the same time.
Generally.
I guess, and generally, or with the same counterparty or related counterparties. I don't know about the generally. And meet one or more of the following three conditions. And those are the interrelated conditions.
Yeah. Good. Let's go with that.
Is this the same counterparty?
Sorry. Generally.
I didn't think about that.
I know, me too. It might be a better way to do that.
Yeah, it would.
Okay. Yes. Okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else on D?
I don't think so.
Hold on.
Modifications.
Yeah.
Tom said something on 3, and my question is, do people interpret 3 as
What's 3?
Sorry, B3. The amount of consideration received in one contract depends on the term of performance of the other contract. I read consideration as cash. Tom made a point earlier about price. This came up in the Ed session. PK's notes say price, so what did you mean? Price interdependence or actual cash consideration, payment?
And it shouldn't be really consideration received because it doesn't depend on whether you can collect it or not.
I think we would have definitely ditched the word received.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's contract consideration.
And then it should be okay.
The price or the amount of the consideration.
The contractual. Price
interdependence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. I'm a little concerned about the vote's been taken, so we can move on if you want. I am concerned a little bit with the recommendation that was just agreed to, because I think the way Tom described it, any two contracts with the same party will be combined and accounted for together just because they're entered into at or near the same time. I don't think we want
that. The indicators are met, though.
He said if any one of the following is met.
It said that they've got to be interrelated, though.
But you moved out near the same time to the lead-in.
That's right.
And
at the same time, same party, and...
But, still to meet one of
them. And then one of the three other conditions below have to be met. It's not just time or counterparty. It's got to be one of the following three conditions.
I don't want to... Waste sports time. But okay. Well, contract modifications. I am a little bit, but I'd probably need to think about it some more. So, yeah. We'll add it to our list of issues for tomorrow. So, yeah, contract modifications is next.
That's C, before C is in cat.
Correct.
Cat?
I'm an animal lover.
Okay. Memo 137C considers improvements to the exposure draft proposed requirements on how an entity should account for contract modifications. In the exposure draft, the board proposed that an entity should apply the principle of price interdependence to determine whether to account for a contract modification as a separate contract or as part of the original contract. If the price of a contract modification is considered to be interdependent with the price of an existing contract, an entity would recognize the cumulative effect of the modification in the period in which the modification occurs. If an entity determines that the prices of the modification and the existing contract are not interdependent, the entity would account for the contract modification as a separate contract. Many respondents agreed that an entity should distinguish between contract modifications that modify the provisions of the original contract and a modification that gives rise to a new contract. Some respondents, however, thought the principle of price interdependence was insufficient to help an entity make that distinction. Respondents thought that the proposal could result in some contract modifications being accounted for on a cumulative catch-up basis, even though the modification relates only to the remaining performance obligations in the contract, or as separate contracts, even though the modifications relate to the original contract, for example, in the case of change orders in the construction industry. Responses did vary somewhat by industry. In general, most respondents from the construction industry supported the cumulative catch-up approach for contract modifications, i.e. change orders, because change orders modify the provisions of the original contract without adding new provisions. Many respondents from other industries, however, indicated that most contract modifications give rise to a new contract and should only affect the accounting prospectively. The staff notes that this feedback is consistent for both private and public companies. The staff agrees with the respondents that the proposed guidance on contract modifications should be improved and proposes a framework illustrated in paragraph 14 to help an entity determine how to account for various types of contract modifications. The guidance for contract modifications should be considered when a contract is not entered into at or near the same time of the existing contract. If an entity determines that only the pricing of the contract has been modified, the entity would apply the proposed guidance on determining and allocating the transaction price, which will be discussed in March. If the entity concludes that the scope of the contract has been modified, the entity will determine whether the modification results only in additional distinct goods and services at their standalone selling price. If yes, then the contract modification for additional goods or services is, in effect, a new and separate contract. Otherwise, the entity should reevaluate the performance obligations and reallocate the transaction price to each separate performance obligation. Paragraph 20 through 24 of the paper provides guidance on how an entity would reevaluate the performance obligations and reallocate the transaction price to each separate performance obligation when the remaining performance obligations are distinct, when the remaining performance obligations are not distinct, or when some of the remaining performance obligations are not distinct. Therefore, the questions for the board is, do the boards agree with the proposed staff recommendation for accounting for contract modifications?
Thank you. PK?
Thank you, Leslie. Before I answer whether I support it or not, I want to understand one question. In 25A, you say if the contract modification results only in the addition of distinct goods or services at the standalone selling price. When you say standalone selling price, it's a price or is it a range of price that is normal in the software industry, 80-20 rule, whatever you want to call it? What do you mean by standalone selling price? Because it could differ from contract to contract, and there is no a standalone selling price other than a list price, which nobody adheres to.
The next month meeting, PK, will be bringing some of the specific selling price and other notions on allocation. But at least if you ask me now, based on even under recently the FASB issued EAW 0881, it uses this estimated selling price, and people interpret it to be a range of price. It need not be one single price. So I would think similar to that notion, people might interpret a standalone selling price to be a range rather than a single price.
So to some extent, we are going to import the software into the general criteria then? And are we going to be very explicit about it?
When people mean like standalone selling price, they generally say you can't have just one single price. It could be a range of price in which what you sell your goods and services. But having said that, we need to bring this issue back in March. I don't want to talk about it on modification, but on standalone selling price and other notion and allocation, we'll be bringing back the comments and feedback in March to the boards.
I agree with what Prasad said about current practice and the range versus a point price, but for purposes of this paper, we talk about it in paragraphs 15 and 16. We mean the selling price as defined in the exposure draft, so paragraphs 15, 16 of this paper.
Okay. So any changes we make to that will be discussed in March. Is your point?
Absolutely.
Paul, did you want to say something, or Philippe?
I was not quite sure about this notion of standalone selling price. We define it in 15 as the price at which the entity would sell a good or service separately to the customer, or is it to a customer? Because if it is to a customer, then you refer to the normal market price for the entity. Or to the customer, how do you know at which price you will sell to the customer, given that there is already a contract in place, an existing contract? I would say that it is absent that initial contract. If it is really standalone, you must consider abstraction with having made abstraction of the existing contract and see that standalone service, how much would I bill to that customer. So it's not very clear here what you mean by it.
I think we do. That is what we intended in paragraph 16. It is the price to that particular customer, and it would consider the existing relationship with that customer.
It was on that same issue. I was going to bring up the same point. So when we talk about standalone selling price and 16, the ability to consider that discount to that particular customer, that's what we're voting for today, or is that piece going to come back?
No, we're just when we say standalone selling price, we're assuming it's the same. Yeah, we're not revisiting it here. We're just using the same notion that was in the exposure draft. To be honest, I'm not sure we would come back with a new definition of the standalone selling price. The feedback in response to the exposure draft was, I think, pretty positive on that. And next month there will be a significant focus on determining the transaction price and allocating the transaction price. And, of course, on a standalone selling price basis, that's what was proposed. But there may be other bases of allocating the transaction price. That's what we'll come back with next month.
But was this notion of considering your relationship part of that general guidance on?
This was in the exposure draft, yes.
Although, to be fair, I think not everybody sort of understood. I mean, the wording of how we defined the standalone selling price was, to quote EFRAG, a bit subtle. And the fact that it is the price to that customer, therefore, takes account that relationship wasn't as clear as it could have been.
Just seems a little contradictory to me. It's not a standalone selling price when you're talking about to that particular customer. It's not standing alone at all, but it's a little tricky.
I'm a bit concerned about the restriction you place here on the fact that a discount can be attributable only, solely, to efficiencies of buying goods or services. What about the efficiency of not having to incur acquisition costs for that contract? This is my customer. I know him. He will come back to me anytime he needs a service. I will give him a discount because I don't have to incur commercial costs. How does it affect my standalone selling price?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, and that is what we're thinking of in paragraph 16. So if there's a modification, the entity adds additional goods or services at, say, the price that a new customer would get, less the costs, sort of direct costs of obtaining the contract, then even though it's slightly less than what a new customer would get those goods and services for, I think it would be consistent with the exposure draft's definition of standalone selling price to that customer.
And so you'd account for it as a separate contract?
Yes, it would be a separate contract.
How do you judge whether that discounts?
How do you judge whether it's significant enough just to take care of customer acquisition costs and it isn't a greater discount that relates to two connected contracts?
That's not the purpose of this paper. I mean, we're just saying if goods and services are added to an existing contract and those additional goods and services are priced at their standalone selling price, count for it as a separate contract. That's all we're saying.
Yeah, but
so this question of judgment, I mean, that's something that's not at the moment, you know, in our plan to come back with. But
well, I agree with the concept that if it's priced like you would if you sold it on your own, that'd be fine. But as soon as you put a range in that price, and that range could be related to really a discount rather than really what you sell it on your own, then it gets a little convoluted.
Well, I think there's the concept and then there's practice. The concept is, and again, this is not anything that we're proposing different from what was in the exposure draft and people seem generally happy with. It's the price at which the entity would sell that good or service to that customer. So the concept is the price to that customer for that good or service. In practice, we appreciate that, you know, for audit evidence and so forth, naturally you have to look at a range of prices because prices might be all over. But, you know, we're focused just on sort of the concept at the moment. I mean, the exposure draft does not define the selling price as a range.
Larry?
Anybody that attended our education session, I apologize, but I'm not sure I'd get this. And it's somewhat related, somewhat, to the topic we just talked about, and that is combining contracts. But really, it's whether we should be separating contracts. So I'm a contractor, and I'm building a brand new house for Leslie. And the house doesn't have a garage, and I'm three-quarters of the way, you know, 90% done with it. And Leslie comes to me and says, geez, you know, we'd really like this garage created over here, this detached garage. And I negotiate a price with her that is clearly below what I would charge Stephen if he called me up out of the blue and said, Larry, I want you to come over and build the exact same garage. Okay, and the reason why the contractual price is lower, there's a number of reasons. First of all, you know, Leslie's a good person. You know, she, we've had a great contract.
Hey, hey.
Oh, I didn't mean that. I'm sorry.
You're up for renewal, Riley.
And you know, all my equipment is there. I don't have another job lined up, you know, to follow the completion of the building or house, et cetera. When I read the criteria here, it seems like I might have to reassess what the amount that I charge Leslie for the building of our house is, and I don't know if that makes sense. And let's say also I'm going to make some money. I'm not going to make a lot of money, but I'm going to still make some money on the garage. Why do I go back and reallocate the total revenue of those two transactions because you want me to under these criteria? It just doesn't make any sense to me. It seems that the user of the financial statement is best served by knowing that I charge $750,000 for the house and I charge $100,000 for the garage. And the margins are greater on the house than the garage. Just that makes total sense to me.
Yeah. I think, is that magic word again? Margins.
It could be that. I had the same type of example, except I was thinking I'm halfway through the house and she wants to change. I'm going to gouge her. She needs the thing. I'm going to charge her a hell of a lot more. But it seemed to me it is a separate thing. I don't have an instant gain. I got to still perform this incremental piece. And in your case, I would agree with what you just said. You've agreed to do it at less than the margin you would have done it at otherwise. But that's what you did now. Clearly what you added is separate. So I just didn't understand why you have to go back and redo it.
Well, are you assuming that the garage is a separate performance obligation? It's
yeah, that's what they're thinking.
Yeah.
But it's still part of, and using your criteria, you'd have to reassess the whole thing.
Yeah, I changed. I embedded it in this contract. I modified the contract. It's a change order.
Right.
But
and you'd want to account for that separately. I think you could, if it is distinct, I think you could account for that as you're suggesting. In paragraph 16, you know, maybe these efficiencies due to the fact that equipment is already on the site. I mean, you could expand the, you know, the description of those efficiencies a bit more.
I mean, but you use the standalone selling price, and clearly I'm gouging the customer. I couldn't do it that way.
Well, I was assuming there that it was consistent with the standalone selling price. That's how you would achieve the separate accounting. But if you're price gouging, then the prices are linked, and you would account for them together.
It's just she wanted a change. I'm the guy building the thing. She's got to go through me to get the change done. And I said, hey, I'm going to take advantage of the situation.
If you apply the contract combination standard here, you would never combine because they weren't entered into at the same time. Yep. And so there's not an interrelationship. It's a separate function.
Yeah, but the whole point of that modification guidance is to say, am I going to account for this as a new contract or not? It's very related.
I'm just thinking.
But so rarely would it happen.
Yep, I got it. So Pat and then Steve.
I guess I'm confused about how you apply the flowchart to Larry's situation, because it certainly added, in my mind, a gooder service that's distinct, because it's a garage, it's not attached to the house. He said it was separate from the house. To me, that's distinct. You could have had another contractor come in and build it. He's charging you, he said, a below market price. It's probably a different price per square foot than he's charging on the house, because it's a lot simpler to build a garage than it is to build a house. So I would say that it's yes, so it would have been yes to those questions, so it would have been a separate contract.
No, I would have said no, because it's not priced at their standalone selling price.
Right, so it seems to me...
Says
so
and.
Yeah, there's two things there. First of all, if it is a separate performance obligation, which I think it may well have been, I think maybe one of the concerns is that the wording in paragraph 16 is a bit narrow and needs to make sure that it takes into effect the discount that you would give, because you don't have to remobilize. You know, you've got people in place. The other thing I just sort of caution is that even if you didn't sort of pass the pricing aspect of this, but it is a distinct performance obligation, sorry, a separate performance obligation that you've added into the contract. In other words, it's not really like a change order. Then I appreciate this is a little bit difficult because we haven't discussed this yet, but one of the things that we do have to discuss more generally is how you reallocate the transaction price. And overwhelmingly, the feedback from that is sort of saying, do not just sort of reallocate to all performance obligations, including satisfied performance obligations, but perhaps allocate it to where it belongs. That might just be the remaining performance obligations. Now, if that were the case, that might mean that even if this thing is a separate performance obligation, but it doesn't qualify as a separate contract, it effectively, the effect could still be that it's sort of very much prospective accounting. I appreciate that's difficult because we haven't done reallocation yet. We're doing that next month. But I think it's just worth flagging at this stage.
So then let's, I think my example, it's easier to come to a conclusion that it's a separate performance obligation. But under John's, where what Leslie's doing in the contract modification is she's just changing something in the house. So
yeah.
It's one performance obligation, okay, to construct a house. But he's three-quarters of the way through the job, and all of a sudden she makes this change. I would hate to go back and reallocate to what you've already done. Can't we take that and allocate it prospectively?
Well, I think there's various things there. I mean, first of all, in the example whereby you really are just changing the single performance obligation, it's not that you're going back. It's just, to some degree, you're reassessing your measure of progress in that contract, and that's why you get an adjustment to the balance sheet balances that you've got. But I think there's a practicality point as well, because in a construction contract, I mean, there can be thousands of change orders, and you're going to end up having to sort of layer them all separately, and I just don't think that's practical. It's not that appropriate. So I still think, Larry, that if it's a single performance obligation, you've changed that performance obligation, and it's not a separate performance obligation being added to the contract. But essentially what you're doing is you're doing a prospective change. The Cume catch is not a retrospective change, it's a prospective change, but it results in a change to perhaps the contract asset balance that you've got, or the contract liability balance you've got recognized.
Prasad, were you trying to get in?
I think Henry has covered it, what I was trying to get in, so I have no additional to add on.
Okay, thank you. Pat,
again? Yeah, I think Larry's example and Henry's response highlights the question of whether or not the contract addition, in addition to it, whether or not it's distinct or not, but whether or not it's being added, if you will, at the standalone selling price. To the extent it's being added at the standalone selling price, I think you have to reallocate. But to the extent that it's not, okay, then I think Dan Larry's got a good point. Why would you bother to reallocate? That's kind of the way I look at it, because you would look at a situation where
if 3/4 of the way through the construction of the house, somebody says, I would like a standalone garage, if the price I'm going to offer you for that standalone garage is essentially the same price as if I wasn't building the house, if you came to me directly or you went to a third-party contractor, that's going to give you one set of results and one set of margins, okay, as opposed to, all right, I'll do the garage, and basically I'm just going to reallocate the price I've already quoted to you for the entire set of activities. So in which case you're going to offer a discount. That's the implication. No, it doesn't come for free, but it, you're not essentially getting the same margin that you would otherwise get on the garage if you quoted them the standalone selling price amount.
I think we've been banging around standalone selling price and whether it's effective or not. And I think there's been enough concern expressed to make us wonder about that. But I'm wondering why we aren't using just the regular performance obligation decisions better, distinct and different timing of revenue recognition. Because Larry has put forward a very effective example of something that's a change order that's new, something new to the contract that is a distinct function and may have different timing. But some change orders also are ones where it's not something brand new. I've changed the type of floor I want in the place. And I don't, in a bigger context, I don't know if that ends up being a distinct function or distinct timing of revenue recognition where it's fitting into a bigger responsibility within the contract. And so if it wasn't a distinct function and timing, do we want separate revenue recognition for those sorts of change orders? And I'm not sure that selling price helps me at all about this, standalone selling price. It might be that we go back to the separate performance obligation decision, and if it's not a separate performance obligation, it's a mod of the contract allocated across the existing contract. If it is a separate performance obligation, it'll have different timing and function. Separately do it.
Can I add, the way I think of it, if I'm adding a garage and I've done that later, I don't care what the selling price is. That, to me, is a brand new thing I'm doing. You had an example in here where you're changing the floor plan, and it seemed to me that now I've integrated them because I haven't done that yet, obviously, and now I've got to do it differently. I could see looking at that as a unit, but I don't see in either case why I would go back and reallocate the total. I think I'd go forward.
I guess in that example, you're not reallocating. I mean, you're reassessing your measure of progress in that single performance obligation, in that example with the change to the floor.
I thought in that floor plan example, I would actually have a higher profit recognized to date when I did that. And that made no sense to me. I mean, that's the way I went through the mechanics of it. You had a profit margin of X. Now the same profit or a different profit margin on a bigger piece or smaller piece gave you more revenue, right? Instantly. I didn't think you could.
What if it's the other way? What if it's the other way, John?
Yeah.
What if it's the other way? Would you recognize it then? Would you change it?
No.
What are you going to do when it is a single performance obligation and you just keep changing the specification of this performance obligation the whole time?
Thousands
of times. To be honest, unless you do what we've done in paragraph 20, I really don't know how you do it.
Okay, hang on, we got people.
And the standard would be completely inoperable for the construction industry.
I completely agree.
Stephen?
Perhaps a problem, not this standalone selling price, because we're sort of assuming it's one number. And yet, to my mind, standalone selling price varies enormously depending upon the bargaining positions of the relative parties. I mean, when a builder operates where I live, they just look at the car in the drive and then they charge accordingly.
And then you bid it.
They're all standalone selling prices.
Absolutely.
That's where it matters. That's why you need a range.
Well, but that's how it's hard to know if you're going to meet this condition. But it's not harder than the application of this principle elsewhere in the document. I don't think it's unique to this issue. Paul, did you want to?
Is the issue, this is the accounting question, whether we do a cumulative catch-up to reflect, I guess, the new assessment of percentage of completion versus only prospective? Is that what we're really debating?
I think that is part of the issue. I think before that point, though, is, and that issue that actually I think is, we're finding it a bit difficult because, as said earlier, we need to come back in March on exactly how to allocate the transaction price, how to reallocate change or allocate changes in the transaction price. So, and we're following up tomorrow on what is a separate performance obligation. So those moving pieces make it difficult to answer that question. I think the first question for the boards right now is sometimes, you know, under the umbrella of an existing contract, an entity and a customer add goods and services that in effect are just a new contract. Have nothing to do with the original contract. They're just a new contract. We're trying to capture those situations when there is an addition of a new contract. How do we craft the guidance to help an entity make that determination? Now, if it's not just a new contract in substance, then you get into the issues of reevaluating the performance obligations and reallocating the transaction price, which could be acute cash or could be prospective.
Larry's example was a new performance obligation added on, but I'm talking more about John's example, which is the change order, the normal change order. And is our discussion of a normal change order cumulative effect versus prospective?
Cumulative. Yeah,
yes, I think, and it is. But I just caution, I think cumulative is a form of prospective accounting. Okay, but it's whether it has an adjustment to the current balances you recognize on that contract, as well as going forward, or is it just going forward?
Adjustment of the current balances means an immediate gain or loss.
A cumulative catch-up,
immediate gain or loss versus the whole thing where it's not a new performance obligation. You have an existing one but modified. Change it going forward. Okay, I'm for prospective.
And I don't understand why you say if there's 1,000 of these, it's not operational prospective. Seems to me it's more difficult to go back and redo them 1,000 times.
Yeah, I think we're talking past each other here, okay? Because, Henry, you keep pointing to this example in paragraph 21 or whatever, and when I look at your answer for that in terms of effectively, I think this is prospective, all right? But I think we're talking somewhat past each other.
But an example where I'm very sympathetic to what the staff is saying is a case in construction where there's a management fee. So you may have performance obligations and a management fee. So there's a combination of services and some other activities going on, like the garage. Let's say I own it, but I'm also paying a management fee. And the contractor has started recognizing the revenue on the management fee over a certain pattern. I throw on some major new deliverable. I can see why you might want to do a cum catch on that because I've changed the scope of the project.
But to Henry's point, it's those types of changes when there are thousands of them in a contract. Operationally, that would be impossible.
Would you not ask?
You're asking us whether or not you want us to have, when you have a contract modification, to take the new activity and put it in the old contract or treat it as a new contract. That's all you're asking. And then in March, we're going to be able to take, when it's combined, when the new activities combine the old contract, as well as when you have changes in estimates, that's when we're going to have to answer the difficult question of cumulative effect or prospective.
Okay. So we can do this all over again.
Right. Because there's a whole bunch of other issues we've got to deal with, and then you get variable consideration, allocation of prices. This is just, right?
I think it's the example in paragraph 20 that is the one that is dependent upon future decisions.
Yes.
except for the allocation decision.
But, Russ, what you said is not what they've got in their paper, because it 23 says you do it on a cumulative catch-up basis.
And that was the proposal if you're modifying a single performance obligation so it doesn't require a reallocation.
Well, I was just reading 21.
Going
to what they said. They kept saying we're going to talk about this in March.
Yeah, the example in 20.
But Henry, you just said what I thought was the driving issue. Is it a new performance obligation or is it not? Is it modifying the existing performance obligation or is it not? And then we talk about allocations after that. So I don't understand why the identification of performance obligation criterion doesn't give you the answer to that question.
How different on page 5, the flow chart, how different is the current definition or description of a separate performance obligation from what's in that box?
Timing is in there for the separate performance obligation. It'd have to be different timing and distinct. It's the timing that's different, and there would be no standalone selling price.
Price is not relevant.
Price is not relevant in terms of...
Well, there's the price interdependency, though, isn't there?
That's if you have two. If you have one contract, you look in there, you're certainly distinct. If you have multiple performance obligations, then you allocate the price to this. I think what we're trying to figure out is, do you in substance have a new contract or not?
You're trying to figure out, and we're not... And at what point do you reallocate? But we're not going to ask how you reallocate.
We could say all modifications, all amendments to contracts are new contracts. All sorts of baggage with that. We could say all amendments to contracts are amendments to contracts. But then you're going to have problems when I actually go to an existing customer and sell the same product. So yeah. I think we're just trying to divide it. Where is it a new contract? Where is it not?
That's right. We're trying to cut that new contract and then... The way this is built, then saying if it's not a new contract, it hinges upon whether you've got, new performance obligations to be evaluated under contract, and the decision there about how the reallocation will work is to be determined.
So the first thing you need is it's got to be distinct, and then the next question is how important is the pricing?
And we sort of said if it's not distinct, then that's when the cum catch comes into play.
Maybe what we should say is it's not distinct. It's part of the old contract. We can discuss how to reallocate in the future.
I would agree with that.
Since we don't seem to be getting anywhere.
I don't know whether that solves the problem in 20.
Well, the only reason we want separate performance...
The whole flowchart came, as I understand, is because of our example doing the exposure draft, which is the para 20.
Yeah,
and
but then
that's how this flowchart came into picture. I don't know the distinct will help us, and I cannot think on fly. I don't know whether the whole problem of 20 will be solved.
Well, 20 is a sort of, there's two things there about, one is are they distinct, and then secondly, how you do the reallocation. And that's the difference between the example in 22, because in 22, it is not a distinct good or service added into the contract. And that's why that results in the cumulative catch-up.
Well, you keep saying cumulative catch-up, and you keep saying you're going to bring it back. What are we doing?
You have a go, because I'm not explaining it clearly. Why the difference between 20 and 22?
John's getting titchy. Turning tardy.
I'm sorry.
The only reason we want separate performance obligations is if there's different timing of revenue recognition consequential to that separate performance obligation. So distinct tells us a separate performance obligation, but we override it in the other model if separating it doesn't make any difference. So it would seem to me that what we're trying to do is decide whether that new addition should have separate timing consequences for revenue.
I think we could. You know, at least I can't see any problems with changing distinct in the flowchart to separate performance obligation. So if it's a separate performance obligation and the pricing is independent or it's priced at a standalone selling price, then that's just a new contract, account for it moving prospectively, you're done with it. I think it's only in those situations where it fails one of those two things that we're just saying that you need to reevaluate the performance obligation to reallocate. But in the situation when there is a reconfiguration of a single performance obligation, such as most change orders in construction, I think we are saying here in this paper that we don't intend to bring that back. That in that situation, it is simply an issue of re-updating your, or I guess updating your measure of progress for completion. And that will result in a cum catch. Because to do otherwise would be, the standard would be completely inoperable for a very significant industry.
Give us the example.
Cum catch works and prospective doesn't. I would have thought prospective would be easier.
Because we would have already concluded that there is just one performance obligation. So having concluded just one performance obligation, that performance obligation is reconfigured hundreds, possibly thousands of times throughout the contract. If each change order is accounted for prospectively, you've got different profit margins and different mechanisms for tracking. You create thousands of contracts where today it's just tracked on one system.
No, let's define the difference between prospective and retrospective, because there's the crux of the matter, okay? When John says prospective and I say prospective, I think what we mean is if our contract costs to date were $100,000, okay, and we add this change order, and our total expected costs for the contract are $150,000, okay, so we're, what is that, two-thirds there.
Can we use the example in paragraph 22?
I was going to give the answer, darn it. Now we change it so that our expected cost to complete the contract is $170,000. Well, then we're only over $170,000 due, and then we account for the increase in the price over the remaining.
That's what I would do.
Over the remaining contract. That's prospective. Retroactive to John and me means I recognize $100,000 or whatever the revenue related to that is, $125,000, let's say. I recognize $125,000 to date, but because you've told me to reallocate, I got to figure out whether $125,000 is what I would have recognized or whether it's $110,000 or what have you. Okay, that's the cumbersome part of it.
I took your example in 23, and where you're 50% done, and what you would do is you would say now you're only 46% done, and your total revenue's 225, so 46% of that's 103. You'd have an instant recognition of 3. And I would have thought I'd look at what I have left to do, what the profit is on what I have left to do.
You already have
recognized. It's gone. Yeah, well, that's what's left to do. And that's how I would, and I don't see why that's an operational issue.
Exactly.
Which you tell me it is.
Go ahead, PK.
Let me give a shot from a different perspective. Maybe that helps. I think it's one performance obligation we have said in the beginning. Okay, so I think we need to stick to that. Having come to the performance obligation, everybody is saying, no, we have to do prospective. And why? What is the system's implication of that? I would think there are tremendous system implications of that. Every time you have different prices, you're putting new layers to the equation. And I think it is definitely very difficult to do it. And I personally think you're always talking about a situation there, Larry, 100 to 150, went up to 100 to 170. Think about 100 to 130. Think about it both ways. All I'm trying to say is that I think if it is a one, you need to, in this example that you have, you put in a floor and somebody changed that floor from a marble to tile because he ran out of money, and still it needs to blend along with the whole thing. He has an obligation for the whole building, not just to the tiles or to the floor. I think the cum catch-up is what is being there. System changes need not be there, and I think that gives a correct picture of what has been done to date and what needs to be done. And I think by this example that John brought out, you're only 46% done. You thought you're 50% done, you're only 46% done.
Yeah.
And that should be reflected.
Yeah. And it would, I think, to do the accounting that Larry suggested. I mean, in this example in paragraph 22, the original expected gross profit percentage was 20%. The additional revenue and costs associated with the change order would be a 25% margin. So if each change order is accounted for differently or separately, you have different profit margins for every change order when you've already concluded that it is just one performance obligation.
It's not so, profit margin, it's the revenue. That's
well, basically, the single performance obligation will morph into multiple corporate obligations.
Pat's going to
okay.
Profit is a consequence.
But that's right.
So, Kenny, I think I heard you say we should be okay if we change the wording of the condition to a separate performance obligation.
Fine, yeah.
Did that crash and burn and I missed it? Or
I heard a lot of people concerned about estimated selling price. I'm okay with it, but I hear other people.
It's, but we would be changing it to say independent pricing, so the opposite of interdependent pricing.
What are you
going to
change?
Where are we?
I don't. About the
flowchart.
Yep.
In the flowchart, and Prasad, come in if you disagree, but in the flowchart, I think we could change A, rather than distinct, we could change it to separate performance obligation. B, I think the notion of standalone selling price is correct, subject to the clarification that we talked about earlier, the efficiencies and so forth. You know, I'd have to think more about different wording, you know, price independence or at a price that's commensurate with those additional goods or services, you know, I mean, there might be potential for different drafting. I can't think on the fly sort of the implications of that. I think the staff's thinking was that these are two notions that we have to define elsewhere in the model anyway. We have to define a standalone selling price. We have to define a separate performance obligation. So we thought it would be very helpful to use notions that are defined elsewhere in the standard. Because if we bring in other words, it's arguably more complex to argue something that seems to be very much the same thing. But
yeah, Kenny, I agree with your comment. When we mean distinct, we do mean separate performance obligation. But in terms of standalone selling price, I agree with Kenny. If we introduce some other principle, then we need to think about what that principle would be and what would be its ramification. All we are trying to say in that first box is, if it is a new contract, if you're buying just additional products, just treat it as a new contract. You don't have to treat it as a modification of an existing contract. But if it's anything else going on, okay, we need to reevaluate and reallocate to figure out what we're going to get the accounting treatment. That's all we're trying to do in this flowchart.
And Prasad, tell me if you agree with this, but I think what we're saying in this box is very similar to what is done today in practice. I mean, for contract additions, under current requirements for construction, those additions are accounted for as a new contract if the nature of the goods and services is different from the original goods and services and if they're negotiated without regard to the price of the original bid. So we think that's very consistent with separate performance obligation or distinct goods and services and, you know, price at their standalone selling price. So we think it's very consistent with what's done today. And even outside of construction, the guidance is not as clear, but in practice, we found that it is very much dependent on an analysis of whether the contract modification creates new scope or is it just a reconfiguration of the existing scope. So we do think it's workable, but we can improve, you know, clarify some of the wording.
Okay. Tom, did you want to get in?
Yeah. You changed standalone selling price there to negotiated separately as the concept, and maybe that works. It's just it remains unclear to me that if you have a separate performance obligation, whether you need any reference to the selling price of the modification to make this work. So if it was just a separate performance obligation, then I would account for the separate performance obligation separately as a separate contract. If it's not a separate performance obligation, then I won't account for it separately, and then we go back to the ideas, do we do it prospectively or retrospectively? If we don't do it retrospectively, I don't think the standalone selling price matters at all, okay, because everything's accounted for going forward, but we're not going to make that decision today. So I just think...
I think the pricing has to be relevant. I mean, when we were just talking about when to combine contracts, it was one of the key indicators. If the amount of consideration in the contract depends on another contract, that's when we're going to say you should probably link those. So it seems relevant here, too, just because you're calling it a modification. The point of it is to say
I understand the concept. I'm just deeply concerned with all the things we threw around here.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think we can make it effective because if you've got a range of prices, I don't know whether it's really priced independently or not.
I mean, I agree with Tom because if we've got another obligation, fine, you just get on with it. There's the price for that obligation and go for it. And the other ones where, in fact, you're doing something else, I think you just meld it in and do it that way. So you would almost get an instant gain in the example you've got on page paragraph 22. You would get an instant gain because instant revenue from what you're saying, if you go retrospective, that's what would happen.
What, in 22?
Yeah. You say 46%, that's it. You'd instantly take an extra 6,000 in revenue or something.
But that would still be just one thing.
And then go forward.
I mean, so we're just sort of saying it hinges upon whether you've added a separate performance obligation to the contract or not.
And you call it
if you have not, then you're going to be in the accounting in paragraph 22.
Yeah.
If you've got a separate performance obligation, then effectively that becomes a separate contract, in
that's
essence.
That's what we're suggesting.
And you don't have to worry about allocation.
Yeah. And forget the price thing. I think that's confusing everything.
Yes.
If you remove the price, as we suggested, now example 20 is the reason for this flowchart in my understanding. How do you separate one contract with another contract when there is a renewal of the this hosting services? Now, if I just put the distinct, will I get to a separate thing at the year 3 when the modification happened, or is it all combined? How does this flow? How does this example fit with the flowchart, revised flowchart?
Well,
you don't need to answer right now. You can tell later, but I don't want to put you on the spot.
I find the two examples we had are very good ones: Larry's garage and the floor. Or whatever it is, and they're quite distinct. The garage is separate, and the price is separate. It's a different obligation, and it's done. You could either gouge Leslie because she wants you to do it, and she's going to wait a year, and you just stick the price up, or you've got all the stuff there, and you can discount it. So the price is almost irrelevant.
I like the gouging option.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's John's thing. He's like
but what
that.
About you have to match the color of the garage with the building?
Don't
and you have to match with the...
Look, you're an auditor today. Subside.
Everywhere else in GAAP where we address this question of when you do a modification of something, are we going to count it as new or a revision of the... We're always looking at, was it at a market price?
I think we need price cutters, basically.
Well, the floor plan's easy because, you know, you've got to build a house. Suddenly you want the stairs at the other side instead of this one, so okay. I quite agree with 22, and I would do what you suggest. I haven't got a problem with that. But building a garage strikes me as something different. You know, if you want an extra wing built on, it's not the same thing. It's
a separate thing. But David, do you think there should be a different economic event if the garage is $5,000? So suppose it normally costs $100,000. Larry comes to me, I say it's $5,000. Or Larry comes to me and says it's $200,000. Wouldn't you think something else is going on there between whether it's $5,000 or $200,000?
Maybe the pricing on the first part
right.
of the contract.
Or pricing on a future contract. Something's odd. That's what the pricing is supposed to help you do. If you just do it on, if you just say it's a separate performance obligation.
Isn't that the combination of contracts criteria that we were talking about before? If Leslie negotiated the contract to build her house 2 years ago, and now she's negotiating to build a garage and it's a different price, I don't think there was anything going on when she originally negotiated that contract. It was 2 years ago. They're totally unrelated.
Agreed, but what's the reason why somebody's going to comp me on the garage basically now?
Maybe it's at a different price because there's been an economic crisis and the builder doesn't have another job in the
foreseeable
future.
But that would be the market price.
That would be the market price.
But that's not what they're saying. The standalone prices. They're saying the standalone price is the price in the original contract.
No. It is the negotiation.
The price that was negotiated with the customer, isn't that
in the new
contract
for that modification
or service? Yeah.
Compared to the, I'm totally confused now.
We got a couple trying to get in. Wait,
now if you know. keep the simple, I will accept totally separate. And one of the notions up to now we discuss about the construction content is about the management, construction contract management piece. If let's assume there is a big contract management piece at the beginning, then we use continuous transfer notion and apply it. And then the two sides negotiate to add another wing. Just from a function part, it is distinct. But during the negotiations, we will not add another piece of the, you know, the contract management fees on top of it. And the whole project will still be supervised by the same team. Should put them together or separate? No, this is another complicated aspect.
I think what Pat said, one of the things Pat said is very important is why don't we pause potentially? We've settled on separate performance obligation, but as far as pricing, why don't you think about taking what was in paper 4D, combining contracts, about price interdependency and the one about design and technology? And see if the change order pricing is dependent upon the first one, that's probably a modification. If the technology associated with the change order is dependent on the first one, that's probably a modification. And see if you can work it so you can get consistent answers irrespective of when you sign the first contract and the second contract, which is the point you made, which I thought was a great point. Okay. Because we don't want to just have it on performance obligations.
I don't know. How is the answer to my question?
One contract.
Maybe you should just say in your example, I think you were saying there's a significant contract management service.
Yes.
Yeah, I think in that situation, we, you know, in accordance with the discussion earlier today, we would say that they're not separable. It's just one performance obligation. But that's something, you know, tonight we've got to craft the words to come back tomorrow to flow by the boards on what we mean by separate risks.
Elka, I'm going to give you the last word.
Okay. That was in David's camp, and I think with the way you've suggested to use the 4D wording, that would solve my problem.
I could accept that, too.
You guys have enough direction?
Stay up all night.
So basically, yeah.
Hey, Prasad.
I want to try one more shot on Larry's example. In paragraph 24, we basically highlight. If a contract modifies a performance obligation and adds distinct goods and services, then we would need to think about how you're going to allocate prices between distinct goods and services versus non-distinct goods and services. So Larry's example in terms of building a garage, if it is distinct, then in March we have to come back to the boards in terms of how do you ring-fence pricing changes, just pricing change only for garage, and the remaining pricing changes for the non-distinct building the house. And then account for it separately. If you do that, you might get prospect accounting just building the garage. So I don't know whether that clarifies it.
So I thought what I heard was the staff was going to consider changing that box to be performance obligation, and then we're not sure about the pricing yet. So you're going to think about whether we can look to the guidance that was in the combining contracts memo to maybe address that.
Yeah.
Contract modification and contract obligation.
But the separate performance obligation is still important.
Right.
We done?
Thank you, Fosby.
Thank you, guys.